So today I'm just going to be doing a little presentation of some notes I've taken from a chapter from a book, this book in my hand, which I guess it's mirror image to you, but it's Democracy Against Capitalism, Renewing Historical Materialism. And it's by Ellen Meeskins Wood. And the chapter we're going to be talking about is called History or Technological Determinism. And this chapter is about what is the most robust way you can kind of define what historical materialism is. And it's going to be looking at ideas put forward by G.A. Cohen and Romer, which is a kind of technological determinist interpretation of historical materialism. And it's going to be putting as a kind of argument against that, it's going to be looking at the work of Robert Brenner, who is a more kind of history focused meaning of what historical materialism is. I'll just get into it, I guess. So, yes, actually, I'm just going to go into the chat. Oh, how can I do that? Screen sharing and everything disappears. I'm going to stop sharing and start again. All right, I'm just going to send you all a file, and if you like, you can read along. So just let me get this file. One second.
We could see your screen share earlier, by the way.
Yeah, I think I had to turn it off. I couldn't work out how to screen share and do
I
chat
mean,
at the
we could.
same
I mean,
time.
we all could see the first page that
Good,
you
good.
were.
So that's working. Yeah. So it's not a complete disaster then.
Sorry, Darren, what are we expecting, you know?
So I'm going to just send you a file, a text file, and you
In the
can if
chat.
you. Yeah, I'm going to put it in the chat. So if you like, you can read this later or look along as we.
Yeah, I think some people might have trouble accessing it. I'm not sure, but
Well, it's
there
just an
we are.
optional. It's just an
There it is,
optional
yeah.
extra. So, right.
Okay, there it is.
As I was. Okay, so I'm just going to start with a quick. So I'm following the structure of the chapter, and the chapter starts with this quick section about explaining the link between class struggle and historical materialism. And what Ellen Meeskin Wood says, the first principle of historical materialism is the organization of material life and social reproduction. Marxism ascribes a determinative primacy to class struggle, not because class is the only form of oppression or even the most frequent, consistent, or violent source of social conflict, but rather because its terrain is the social organization of production which creates the material conditions of existence itself. So, class conflict has a particular historical resonance because it implicates the social organization of production, the very basis of material existence. Class struggle has a distinctive potential as a transformative force because whatever the immediate motivations of any particular class conflict, the terrain of struggle is strategically situated at the heart of social existence. So those were Ellen Meeskin's words, not mine. So I think, so at the beginning, she's just trying to set up this idea of what we're looking at in historical materialism is how our different societies, how they organize their way of reproducing themselves. And then related to this is class relations and how surplus labor, or in the case of capitalism, surplus value is extracted. So I'm going to maybe pause at every section in this talk just so you all don't fall asleep. So probably this section is quite uncontroversial or anything, but if anyone has any questions right now to ask about this section, say so before I move on. I'll give you 30 seconds. Okay, yeah, Andy, you got your hand up.
Sorry about that. I was muted and sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, I don't know if it's worth explaining at the outset, Darren, a bit more about Ellen Myskins Wood. I don't know a lot about her, but I do know she was a big name when I was a student.
Yeah.
Well, and, but the only thing I do know about her is that, and this is very, very crude, is that she apparently developed this sort of concept of political Marxism.
Yes, yes.
Which she thought trumped, no pun intended, but outvalued economic Marxism, and so that's something.
Yeah, I'm going to get into this later on when I talk more about Brenner. So Brenner and Myskins Wood are their political Marxist people, but I will get into this. Yeah.
Oh well, thank you, because I know absolutely nothing about Brenner, so I look forward to that. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So on to the next. So this is the next kind of subsection of this chapter, and it kind of describes, well, two Marxist theories of history. So one is, we could call it technological determinism, and this idea is basically history is driven by universal trans-historical development of productive forces, and class relations are shaped by technological advancement. So the important thing here is, if you take this kind of technological determinism idea, especially as it's developed by Cohen and the rational choice Marxists, they're kind of saying that historical materialism is supposed to be some kind of trans-historical theory which can explain the movement of history across all periods of history. And the thing that moves societies is to do with the development of technology and the productive forces. The other reading of historical materialism, we can maybe call it a kind of more historical specificity reading of it, and this is the one more associated with Brenner and Ellen Myskins Wood. And this one, the idea here is, if there is a universal law, the universal law is that each specific period of history has its own distinct and internal dynamics. And here we need to focus on the specific property relations of these different forms of society to work out what the laws of motion are within these different forms of society. So I'm going to get into this more over the next few slides. So at the time, so this book was written in 1995. At the time, there was a thing, rational choice Marxism was very popular. And here, the main target here is a guy called John Romer. He kind of built upon the ideas from G.A. Cohen, who I'm taking to know you all may have at least heard the name. He wrote a very famous book about Marxist theory of history. And so on Romer's understanding of what a Marxist conception of history is, he says that history is an evolution of property relations towards a greater socialization. So what this means is less and less things become acceptable to be held as private property. So you can think of in slaves owning societies, you know, it's acceptable to own another person as a form of property. Capitalism comes along and then it's, you know, this is not something that's acceptable to own as a form of property. And you're kind of getting a greater and greater socialization. In Roemer's and Cohen's conception or interpretation of Marx, its technological development is the deep cause, and class struggle merely facilitates. So I think I'll try and read a section. So, okay, yeah, so this is, again, I'm reading from the chapter. So Roemer, he tries to, so rational choice Marxism is a type of a game theory. So here, so Roemer says, he asks us to imagine a feudal system with lords and serfs, but one in which a nascent capitalist economy is emerging alongside the feudal system. Now, there is an option. Capitalist and feudal lords can compete for the control of the working population. If the technology or forces of production that the capitalists are using enables them to pay higher real wages than serfs can earn, then there is an economic advantage to the liberation from serfdom that did not formally exist. So in this rational choice Marxism, we have three levels of explanation. We have a deep cause, which is the development of technology, technological determinism. We also have the historical process, so there's the successive elimination of forms of exploitation or the progressive socialization of property. And we have a facilitator, in this case, the class struggle, which facilitates bringing about a process which was bound to come sooner or later. So I'm going to go on to a critique of this idea from Roemer. So there's a kind of there's a choice fallacy here, basically. So if you know, so Roemer says, imagine a feudal system in which there's capitalists and there's feudal lords and there's serfs which can choose their employer. So Woods, Ellen Meeskin Woods says, well, you know, this isn't a historical description. For a start, you know, would serfs be willing to trade their secure access to land for the uncertainties of a, you know, entering the market as a wage labourer? This ignores the coercive power of feudal property relations. So in the feudal system, this is what makes a serf different to a wage labourer. If you're a serf, basically you're under the control of the lord, so you cannot, even if there was like a kind of Fordist factory suddenly appeared at the end of your village or whatever, you couldn't choose to go there because your labour is controlled by the feudal lord. So kind of rebuttal of this argument is it treats capitalism as an always available option, but it can only do this by thought experiments, by hypothetical scenarios, rather than looking at the actual, you know, what are the actual relations of a feudal society? What are the property relations? So there's a kind of, with these types of explanation by Roemer, Cohen, even Adam Smith and this type of thing, they can't, there's a question begging, because in order to explain the origin of capitalism, they have to presume that capitalism is already in existence, and then it just gets larger. So Brenner kind of rejects this idea, and this is where the whole political Marxism idea comes in. So according to Brenner, the transition to capitalism arose from the specific rules of reproduction of the feudal actors trying to maintain their positions. So this, it's not fully developed here, but there's a later book by Ellen Meeskins Woods called Origin of Capitalism, The Longer View. And this kind of shows how a change in the nature of feudal rents, once they became tied to basically productive output, this then generates a mechanism for having to continually improve the productivity of land, and this is what gets the capitalist relationship going. So instead of thinking of capitalism as an imperative, instead of thinking of capitalism as an opportunity, it's probably better to think of it as an imperative. So in feudal systems, market opportunities, they do exist, but this is something where you just take your surplus product. It's not something which you're dependent on for reproducing your daily existence. So this is the difference between market imperatives and market opportunities. If you're living under a society of market imperatives like capitalism, you must produce for the market, you must produce at a profit, or you're going to not be able to reproduce yourself. This is different in feudalism because serfs have access to the land. They can produce their own existence without being reliant on the market. And likewise, lords are not reliant on the market for their survival because they extract from the peasants through extra economic means, through, you know, once a year or whatever, the peasants have to give a certain percentage of their product. If they don't, they will face the coercive force of the lords, so physical violence. So transitions require transformation of property relations and not an adoption of capitalist options. So let me just quickly look at what I took from the chapter. Let's see if I can read a paragraph that makes this better. Okay, so Brenner, so this is Ellen Meeskins Woods writing. So Brenner offers an explanation of the transition to capitalism, which relies entirely on the dynamics of feudal relations and their conditions of reproduction. Without reading capitalism back into its predecessor or presenting it as an available option. This project also requires an acknowledgement that pre-capitalist property relations have a logic and tenacity of their own, which cannot be conjured away by the convenient assumption that people are driven by an urge to make the next available capitalist option, an urge that existing structures cannot resist. So, okay, so I'll stop here again, and maybe any thoughts, questions, clarifications? Anyone want? So I think I saw Steve first, and then I saw Dan Electro.
Okay, if I can go first, but very quickly, just to clarify something for people who perhaps haven't read Brenner or Meeskins, when you talk about reproduction, and you're actually talking about the reproduction of the lord as the lord, the peasant as the
yeah,
peasant.
Yes, exactly. Because that might mean, because it might say, I'm not talking about child rearing, or, I mean, what do you need to do to keep yourself in the same position as you are in society now? What do you need to do to keep, you know, tomorrow, next year, the next decade, what do you need to do just to keep it, keep everything?
Yeah, thanks.
So I guess Dan.
Hi, I'm Danny. I'm from Chicago. Hi, you Dan. Probably didn't realize you were going to attract an international audience. I'm enjoying the talk a lot. I haven't read any of the books that you've discussed, but I made some notes. I may look into some of them.
Yeah.
And it's been a while since I've actually even had to think about the motor of history, so to speak, because I think that's something distinct from just recognizing that all prior property society had classes, right? To actually make an argument that, you know, the class nature of society actually moved history in a certain direction.
Yeah.
When you look at just technology alone, what seems a little paradoxical, though, is that when you look at antiquity and the era of what was predominantly slavery, you know, technology was very significant. When you think of these incredible buildings and, you know, the Roman aqueducts and sewers and roads and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
When you get into feudalism proper, and of course, slavery always existed throughout feudalism too. But if we think of feudalism in Europe as a predominant system, at least the way I think of it, as I'm missing something mentally on my own here, I think it was almost a step backwards in terms of technology. The technology seems much more primitive than what we saw before. Now, of course, as soon as capitalism comes along, it's an explosion beyond belief of technology, since science was also developing as an intellectual venture that the capitalists, you know, took enormous advantage of. So it seems that aspect of it does seem a little bit to somewhat weaken the idea that technology alone is a part of that motor. I think that it's hard to see class struggle as being a motor of history until we really look at capitalism, where it's obvious that the capitalists had a revolution that definitely was trying to, a revolution that was, you know, the result of feeling very constrained by the rule of the aristocracy and the church. You know, they needed something that was going to meet their needs better. So there you can really definitely see how the class struggle plays out. It's very difficult, I think, to see it with regards to earlier systems, though.
Yeah.
But anyway, just
So you've actually,
random thoughts. Yeah.
You've actually preempted a coming slide with a thing about Rome. Okay. So I'm going to move on. So historical specificity and the transition to capitalism, or in the chapter, this section is actually called A General Theory of Historical Specificity. So capitalism emerges from specific changes in agrarian class relations, agrarian property relations, and not from trade and markets alone. So the idea is, in feudalism, the peasant has a guaranteed piece of land. They can produce themselves. They don't need to go out into the labor market to sell themselves. They have their own means of reproducing themselves. So markets aren't inherently capitalist. Obviously, you know, we have markets in feudalism, we have markets in Roman times. Probably something, you know, going back into further prehistory, we have examples of people exchanging things. But when capitalism arises, markets become structural imperatives. So this is the big difference, that the whole of how everybody reproduces themselves is by going to the market, either to sell their labor power, or if you're a capitalist, to buy labor and means of production, labor power and means of production. So when we're talking about, you know, this, the technological determinism idea that, you know, technology gets gradually more and more productive, better and better, you know, if there's a less productive technology, this is going to get knocked out by a more productive one. But I'm going to say this is actually historically unique to capitalism. It's not a general law. So, let's see. I'm going to go back to put my reading glasses on. Actually, I'm getting old. So, let's see what I can pull out from the chapter quickly. Okay, so it's one thing to say that capitalism, so I'm reading again, this is Ellen Meeskin Woods, not me. It's one thing to say that capitalism uniquely fosters technological development. It is quite another to contend that capitalism developed because it fosters technological development, or that capitalism had to develop because history somehow requires the development of productive forces, or that less productive systems are necessarily followed by more productive ones, or that the development of productive forces is the only available principle of historical movement from one mode of production for another. So I put this quote in bold, so I must have thought it's important. So at the foundation of every social form, there are property relations whose conditions of reproduction structure social and historical processes. So I think the kind of understanding of historical materialism that Meeskin Woods wants to put forward here is basically this one of, it's a general law of historical specificity. So each different form of society has its own form of property relations, and these form of property relations structure social reproduction. And it's when these property relations change, forms of society change. So does Marxism need a unilinear view of history? So you get, this is a very common criticism of Marxism. Actually, and criticism of this Cohen technological determinism, I'm not sure why, maybe it's just because the algorithm is sending things towards me, but I've seen three or four popular pieces just recently written about why Marxism is wrong, and they're all talking about this, the Cohen book. But so this is from the chapter, not me. So one of the most serious and frequent criticisms levelled against Marxism has been that it subscribes to a mechanical and simplistic view of history, according to which all societies are predestined to go through a single inexorable sequence of stages, from primitive communism to slavery to feudalism, and finally to capitalism, which inevitably gives way to socialism. Marxism, according to this view, needs a more or less unilinear conception of history, conceived as a universal pattern of systematic and constant growth of productive forces, and without it, the socialist project is deeply compromised, because on this conception of history depends the conviction that the inevitable rise of capitalism will prepare the ground for socialism with equal inevitability. John Gray, who you may have heard of, is quite a famous small c conservative historian. So John Gray wrote in an article called The System of Ruins in the Times Literary Supplement, 30th of December 1985. Contrary to G.A. Cohen's attempted reconstruction of historical materialism in Darwinian functionalist form, a mechanism for filtering out ineffective productive arrangements exists only within the capitalist mode of production. In a capitalist market economy, there is a powerful incentive for enterprises to innovate technologically and to adopt innovations pioneered by others, since firms which persist in using less efficient technologies will lose markets, reap dwindling profits, and eventually fail. Nothing akin to this selective mechanism of market competition existed in the Asiatic mode of production, and it has no replica in existing socialist command economies. Cohen's defense of the development thesis is bound to fail, because it attempts to account for the replacement of one productive mode by another by invoking a mechanism which features internally in only a single mode of production, market capitalism. So Mieskind's Wood quotes this in her chapter, but she then goes on to say, John Gray is here so precisely on the mark in his insistence on the singularity of capitalism and his characterization of that system as uniquely driven by a powerful incentive to revolutionize productive forces, that it seems churlish to point out that Marx thought of it first. The uniqueness of capitalism in this respect, far from constituting an embarrassment to Marxism, is the very core of its theoretical being. It was Marx who first provided a systematic explanation of this unique phenomena. Indeed, it was Marx who recognized that it required an explanation and could not have taken for granted, as inscribed in human nature, whether in the natural development of human reason, or in the inclination to truck, barter and exchange, or in human acquisitiveness and or indolence. And it is still Marxists who are making the most serious efforts to develop and improve this explanation. So, before I start talking about this next slide, does anyone have any thoughts, or are they anybody lost or confused? Yeah, Howard. Yeah.
A couple of things, Darren, which surprised me a bit. There was that slide is it Jerry Cohen who said that? I can't remember. But it said markets are not inherently capitalist, but only become capitalist when tied to, I can't remember what now, surplus value or whatever. I mean, what are we to make of that? I mean, you know, it reminds you of all this talk you get from some people on the left about market socialism, that, you know, famous contradiction in terms. I mean, well, what is that argument that markets are not inherently capitalist?
Well, okay, so this would be from Brenner and Mieskind Wood saying this. But I mean, it's correct, because, you know, capitalism is only, what, 200 or 300 years old. Merchant capital, wage labour, markets, all these things predate capitalism. So it doesn't mean, you can't say if a society has wage, labour, markets, merchant capital, it's capitalist, because then you're basically saying, you know, ancient Rome is capitalist. So the thing that makes a capitalist society capitalist is to do with the specific property relations. But then market socialism, I mean, this is more, the question there is, you know, what's the definition of socialism? So you can say markets pre-exist capitalism, but, you know, could you have markets in socialism? That's kind of a different question.
Completely different, yeah. All right. Okay, yeah. I take your point. A couple of other things, very quickly.
Yeah.
Somebody seems to be quoting Jerry Cohen, to say that his writings show that the Marxist view of capitalism is wrong. I mean, what does that mean exactly?
Well, I mean,
how are they doing that? How are they managing to do that?
Basically, it depends how you interpret it. And so this is kind of what I'm leading to. So I'll just leave it at that for now.
Okay. And finally, as for John Gray,
yeah.
Oh God, I wouldn't touch him with a barge pole. Stuff he comes out with, you hear him on the radio quite a lot. He's probably fairly elderly now, but heavens, and it's such trite stuff as well. He says things like you can't trust any ideologies. Life is much more sort of subtle and varied, and so on and so forth. And in the end, sort of, you know, his view of the world adds up to you called him a conservative. Yes, a profound conservative.
Yeah, I mean, probably the most ideological people are those who think they don't have an ideology.
Yeah, it's a good point. Yeah.
So I think I think Steve and then Andy was the order. I don't know.
No, Andy first.
Oh, okay.
I only just stuck my hand up, really, just to say something very briefly. It was just on the back of what Howard said about, I think Howard had said, and I don't want to annoy Howard, but it came across to me like Howard was saying there was no market economies before capitalism. Well, there were. There was also class struggle before capitalism, and Marx fully understood that. So that's all I wish to say. Yeah.
Thanks for the clarification, Andy.
Well, if I could come in now.
Yeah, I guess it's over to you.
Yeah, just, well, one thing that Danny said before about the feudalism not being this technological development over the Roman Empire's technology. Well, that's probably right. But you've also got to remember that the technology that was available to the Roman Empire wasn't available generally throughout Europe. It would be in certain areas of the geography. Certainly not everybody had sewers and hot baths and stuff. They were specific little not available to everybody. Yeah. And neither were the relationships of Roman society applicable throughout Europe. By the way, we are just talking about Europe here. It's a bit weird to be so Eurocentric. But okay, for the purposes of the discussion, we'll have to let that go. Just one other brief thing. What we need to be conscious of is that Marx talks about capitalism as the, as you were saying, the social relation between private property and propertyless labourers, but that certainly would have existed in very small pockets. I mean, one example I've come across is the silver mines in Greece were possibly run on a cap on a, on a. Well, they were actually on a slave labour basis in the main, but there would have been pockets of wage labour. But the issue is that it was not generalised. And what capital is about is capitalist society is the generalised nature of commodity production. I think the amount of commodity production is relevant.
Yeah,
that's it. Thank you.
Yeah, good. Yeah, we're going to get to the Romans in the next slide or the one after. So.
Yeah, what did they ever do for us?
Yeah, exactly. I think Richard wants to say something.
Really interesting, Gary. Thanks. I've lots of kind of questions that have actually been poking up in my mind. And because I'm not an expert on them, I can't say anything sort of conclusively, but just a few issues. One is that there has been a kind of change in the understanding about wage labour in earlier societies, and it's now believed that in the classical period in Greece and Rome, wage labour was much, much more extensive than we once thought. And in fact, as some historians are now saying, it's actually would be inaccurate to describe sort of ancient Greece and Rome as slave societies per se, that there is so much wage labour actually that there was actually going on at that time. But again, this is just sort of incidental kind of things that I've actually kind of read here and there, and I can't sort of say with any sort of clarity how true that is. But one thing that I think is, to me, has always felt to be really important about the nature of the market is that capitalist markets are price determining, which wasn't the case in earlier markets, as far as I can ascertain. That, in fact, as Steve was saying, because the market was not universal and obligatory means of obtaining wealth or exchange or whatever, there wasn't, the market was unable to determine price itself. And in fact, throughout the medieval period, prices had to be set either by a local authority or occasionally by a community. And that's where you get sort of E.P. Thompson and his theory about a moral economy, that in fact prices were set in order to allow every section of society to at least get some sort of a living. So they weren't set so high that peasants could, that sort of, or labourers couldn't survive, and they weren't set so low that that manufacturers, bakers, etc., couldn't survive. So that seems to be a kind of significant difference between market. They just seem, the capitalist market does seem to have taken on a different character to earlier markets, even though that they were sort of extensive throughout history. There are other things that I just sort of put a question mark by, which I'll come back to.
So there's nine sections in this talk, so.
So you need to get on that, okay.
So I think the important thing to think about, what we're thinking about here, is what caused this change from, prices being set by guilds, how many employees a workplace could have. This was set by guilds. What caused this change? Was it technological development? Just suddenly, hyper-productive ways of producing developed and this caused the change, or was it something else? So this is kind of the question we're thinking about. So all these numbered sections, these are subsections of the chapter. So again, so this is counterposing the two different ways of thinking about what historical materialism could mean. So is it a universal history, or is it something to do with specific, how different forms of society, how they're specifically different? So let me just see if there are nice quotes. Okay, so Marx's theory of history, according to Ellen Meeskins Wood, does not take the form of propositions like primitive communism is as in must be, followed by slavery, etc., but rather something like the fundamental key to the development of feudalism and the forces at work in the transition to capitalism is to be found in the specific mode of productive activity characteristic of feudalism, the specific form in which surplus labour was pumped out of the direct producers, and the caste conflicts surrounding the process of surplus extraction. So this kind of proposition gives full recognition to both historical specificity and structural constraints. So as a general theory, there's always structural constraints to forms of society, but these forms of society, they have their own specific constraints. So this section is where Meeskin Woods talks about the famous, the 1859 preface to the Critique of Political Economy. And it's this idea of forces versus relations of production. So I'm going to read a little paragraph. The proposition that history is simply the inexorable progress of productive forces is vacuous and by itself inconsistent with Marx's analysis of capitalism. It can accommodate a whole range of possibilities, from the revolutionizing of productive forces under capitalism to the tendency of productive forces to petrify in pre-capitalist societies. the sense in which it is true is very limited in its explanatory value and begs the critical question of capitalist development. Of course, it is indisputable that in a very long perspective, there has been a broadly evolutionary development of material productive forces, but this need mean no more than changes in the forces of production tend to be progressive and cumulative. That once an advance occurs, it is seldom completely lost, and that regression is over the long term exceptional. If this is so, it's still possible to characterize these developments as evolutionary and directional, though not teleological, in the sense that there is a general progressive tendency and each development is accompanied by new possibilities as well as new needs. So I don't know whether I need to explain the word teleological, but this is an idea that things develop because there's some kind of inner purpose or inner essence inside them. It's kind of from Aristotle or something. But I don't know. Anyone want to say anything here? I might read a couple more quotes. No one puts their hand up quickly. Okay, I'm going to read another quote. The principle in question goes something like this. Forces of production tend to develop. At some point, they come up against the limits imposed by production relations, which make further development impossible. This contradiction compels productive forces to break through the restrictive entanglement, requiring relations of production to change and allowing forces to advance. The main canonical source for this proposition is Marx's 1859 preface to the Critique of Political Economy. And I have no intention of denying this textual warrant, nor do I intend to enter into a debate about the textual evidence or about its significance, except to say that both Marxists and their critics have placed an enormous theoretical burden upon Marx's shorthand aphorisms, notably those about the contradictions between forces and relations of production, and those about base and superstructure. Without taking into account their rarity or their poetic elusiveness and economy of expression, and without putting into the balance the weight of his whole life's work and what it tells us about his theoretical principles. So here's a bit about the Romans. Again, I'm just reading a few paragraphs. Although evidence is sparse, it can be argued, as Marx and Engels incidentally did argue, for example, in the German ideology, that the result was a destruction of productive forces, a regression from the development of Roman antiquity. At any rate, long after the crisis, indeed, after the better part of a millennium, the level of material life remained very low, and economic growth, when it did occur, for a long time was based not so much on the improvement of productivity as on the extra-economic logic of a war economy, the logic of coercive appropriation and pillage. Feudalism did eventually bring about technological developments, though their extent remains a subject of controversy. But by this time, surely, the causal thread between the crisis of antiquity and the development of productive forces has worn rather thin. The connections would be exceedingly tenuous even if the order of causality were reversed. From developing productive forces which strain the fetters of restrictive production relations, of productive relations changing in order to encourage the advancements of stagnant productive forces. If we are prepared to accept this kind of timescale, we could probably claim a direct causal link between almost any two widely separated historical episodes. So I'll stop there. So if you think, we have the famous passage, you know, I'm sure most of us can more or less pull it out from memory. Maybe I can't. where this is about the, you know, productive forces being developed, and you know, there's fetters and they have to break through. But if you look at the actual argument, when Marx does actually talk about the development of capitalism, especially in Capital, this isn't the story you actually get. You get, so the story in Capital isn't someone building a Fordist production line and then getting workers. It's more like there's changes in the dynamics of social relations, and then this leads to the need to develop these kind of hyper-efficient ways of producing. So, yeah, I don't know if anyone wants to say anything more here, or I can move on to number 8 out of 9. Okay, so this is just a, this is just to continue with what I was talking about before. So the conventional forces outgrow relations.
Sorry, Darren, Andrew wants to say
something. Oh, Andy, sorry, I didn't see.
Yeah, well, apologies in advance for the question, because I may have missed some information as we were going through. I had to go away from the screen for about 5 minutes. But I think, well, I'll just say it as it is. I'll just say what I'm thinking. One of the things I always think about being a socialist, being a, you know, whatever we call ourselves, you know, whatever I call myself from time to time, but a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, I always think our mission, and it's not our sole mission, we're not a vanguard party, but our ultimate sort of what we would like to see is a transformation of society through, well, we talk about democratic means, etc. So I don't want to take too much time on this, but my sort of understanding of all other really epoch changing things that have happened hasn't come about by the conscious action of a mass of people, you know, which is essentially what Marxism in action is all about, really. It's about, you know, the working class will become conscious and will establish a different form of society. It sort of ties in a bit, I think, Darren, to the last slide you had, where it's about, you know, what has happened previously is social and his, you know, sort of social and productive changes and developments have gradually sort of moved societies into different forms of social organization. And so the move from feudalism wasn't really into capitalism wasn't really any sort of revolutionary act. It was just a sort of a transitional, organic kind of development. And that's something I've always just sort of thought, how does this work? Because what we're trying to do, as it seems to me, is to do something that's never, ever been done before. You know, we're actually trying to do it under the aegis, if I may use that word, of human agency.
Yeah.
So anyway, I'll stop at that.
I'll hold that thought for the last slide, because then that's a bit more relevant then. So okay, so what we're just looking at here on the screen, this is just another brief summary of what I said before. So the conventional idea that forces outgrow relations is probably too vague to describe historical transitions, and I mean, if you think technology is the underlying thing, I mean, you know, some places that advanced technology, you know, China, didn't end up in capitalism, at least not, you know, at the same time as in Western Europe. And so productive forces alone cannot explain transitions without looking at property relations and class dynamics. So I'm now on to the next section of the chapter, So if the forces and relations of production contradiction has meaning, this is something that is specific to capitalism. And this is because, so the whole Cohen idea, the technological idea, yeah, so he's kind of trying to say Marxism is kind of like a Darwinism of technology, that new technologies are developed if they're more productive, and it's like kind of history or class struggle is the thing that knocks out the least productive forms of organization. But like we said, and like Gray also said correctly, that, you know, actually this this dynamic is only specific to capitalism, because it's only in capitalism where it's a completely market society and survival is dependent on being competitive. Let me just see if I can find... How are we doing for time? Okay, let's just see if I can find a nice paragraph from this section to read out. Okay, so, and this is Ellen Meeskinswood. It is surely significant that in Marx's own accounts of historical transitions, the development of productive forces plays little role as the primary motor. This is true even in his explanation of the transition from feudalism to capitalism. His most comprehensive accounts of pre-capitalist societies in the Grundrisse and of the historical transition to capitalism, especially in the section on primitive accumulation and capital, do not invoke the development of productive forces as a motivating impulse of historical change. They are, in fact, based on the premise that what needs to be explained is precisely the origin of capitalism's distinct drive to improve forces of production. I nearly said destruction for some reason. There are two ways of looking at this curious fact. One is to say there is a fundamental inconsistency between, on the one hand, his general theory, as stated boldly, for example, in the 1859 preface, which treats the advancement of productive forces as the motivating force of history in general, and on the other hand, his analysis of capitalism as unique in its drive to advance technological development. The alternative, as I've already suggested, is to reconsider what is general in his general theory. And so our best argument is, so the general thing about historical materialism is the specificity of different epochs. So, and then Meeskinswood says, Marx conducts his critique of political economy, the core of his mature work, by differentiating himself from those who took for granted and universalised the logic and dynamic of capitalism, without acknowledging the historical specificity of its laws, or seeking to uncover what produces them. Marx, unlike the classical political economists, and indeed a host of other ideologues of commercial society, did not assume that the progress embodied in modern society was simply the outcome of a drive inherent in human nature or natural law, but insisted on the specificity of the capitalist demand for productivity and the need to find an explanation for it. So now we have, how long have we got? Yeah, that should be fine. Okay, so what are the implications for this to the socialist project? So if we think I've been talking about these two ways of interpreting Marx. So you have technological determinist view, and this, but on this view, a certain reading of it, you could call this productive forces Marxism. So that the view is here that what socialists should be doing is improving the productive forces, improving productivity. Once you do this, you know, socialism will kind of emerge more or less automatically. And this view is mostly associated with Stalinism, you know, the USSR. And then you have this other historical materialist view that, you know, the goal of socialism. So what is different about each of these preceding forms of society is how surplus labor or surplus product or surplus value is extracted. But what our goal should be is the reproduction of these means of production, of the means of production by direct producers. And this way of thinking about what the goal of socialism is much more democratic, as it has, you know, the goal of true socialism is the free association of the producers, you know, the free development of each, you know, free development of all. And this is not merely an extension of capitalist efficiency. So what would a socialist system be like if socialism is not capitalism, and if it is a system of the freely associated producers who all own, you know, own and control the means of production in common? Then socialism would be a system with its own logic. It wouldn't be driven by profit maximization, accumulation, or the notion of technological progress. So when we're thinking about this, you know, do we have to choose between determinism or contingency? So this is, you know, some critics say, well, if you reject technological determinism, then you're saying that history is purely contingent. It's just all a matter of luck. But that's a false dichotomy. The alternative is history. You know, what we have to do is look at the specific constraints, the specific social forces of each society. And from this, we can understand, you know, what specific structural constraints there are. So, losing my voice a bit. I'll read some sections from this last section, and then we can just finish off with an open discussion. Okay, so if there is in Marx a systematic statement of a very general trend in history, a single direction in which all human history has tended, then his remarks on the increasing separation of direct producers from the means of their own labour, subsistence and reproduction are both more systematically developed, see in particular the discussion of pre-capitalist formations in the Grundrisse, and more useful than technological determinism. And they also set the terms for his conception of socialism. Technological determinist Marxism tends to suggest that the object of socialism is to perfect the development of productive forces. It is not surprising that this version of Marxism was most congenial to a Soviet regime overwhelmingly preoccupied with rapid industrialization at any price. The other version of Marxism, which takes its inspiration from Marx's own account of, in brackets, Western history, as the increasing separation of direct producers from the means of production, suggests a different project for socialism, the reappropriation of the means of production by direct producers. The first project, even apart from Stalinist deformations, was likely to be driven by undemocratic impulses as the forced acceleration of economic development proceeded at the expense of working people. The other project has at its core the highest democratic aspirations, summed up in Marx's definition of socialism as, in its foundations, a free association of the producers. So we are not obliged to accept a Manichean choice between determinism and contingency. The real alternative to both is history. Even a complete repudiation of grand narratives in the postmodern manner does not dispose of historical causality. And even at a time when history seems to be defying socialist aspirations in the most dramatic a decisive way. We need not, should not, choose between the promise of historical inevitability and the denial of any historical foundation to the socialist project. Okay, so that was my brief synopsis of what was in this chapter. I hope it was clear. There's probably a lot I missed out, but over to you guys. So I think Steve was first and then it was Dan.
A couple of points. I think she's called Meeksons, not Meekskins.
That's it, yeah, Meekskins, yeah. It's funny
That wasn't the point I wanted to make.
Yeah.
We had a look at the is it the Origins of Capitalism?
It's a nice little book, a short one.
Well, the point that I wanted to make is that I found it far more useful to read the Brenner text on which most of Meeksons' arguments were based. Very, very, very interesting. And I mean, you're probably aware of this, Darren. It gave rise to Brenner's text gave rise to the Brenner debate.
They're gathered in a book,
I think Brenner gives far more detail about his arguments about the development of capitalist relationships in the countryside than the Meeksons does. But having said that, reading Meeksons, she was we found that she was very, very close to the SPGB viewpoint. Very close. I'm surprised that I'd never come across her before we held this study group on it. Just those two observations. And one more thing about just to go back a little bit to what Danny said earlier on about there being no class struggle in feudal times. I think the peasants that ended up revolting in Germany, for example, and in Germany and in England, and France. Would disagree with you that there was class struggle between peasants and aristocrats. Leave it at that. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. So we got 10 minutes left. So Danny and then Cromran.
Yes. Thank you. Just a few thoughts. First of all, I just want to clarify. I don't think I stated that there was no class struggle in feudalism. I was only talking about the technology.
Yeah.
Without doubt, there have always been struggles by the dispossessed against the possessed throughout history. But I wanted to just a few thoughts. I think I agree with your conclusion about the problems with technological determinism. One of the reasons I think it's a problem is because the arrival of property society itself was not inevitable, I think. And I think, you know, if you read certain like anthropologists, like David Graeber, for example, I mean, he discusses how, and it's all conjectural. I mean, he doesn't really have enough evidence to say solidly this, but he's arguing that there must have been hundreds of years in which in a certain part of the Middle East, or at North Africa, wherever, tribal shamans evolved into what would become priests, and tribal chiefs evolved into what would become kings. And, you know, and that was sort of an aberration of history, one could say, because for hundreds of thousands of years, humans were already living in a free society, in the society that Marx calls primitive communism. So when we look at our entire history and we look at the differences of the different modes of production in our civilization, we have to remember that those differences are not as big in some sense as the development of very revolutionary and aberrant institutions like the state or property, or how we view each other suddenly, how one human viewed another human, or how they viewed the indigenous people who are now living out in the country, way outside of the city walls, how we looked at them, or how we looked at nature for that matter. All these are sort of aberrant views that we still have thousands of years, 10,000 years later. And so I think that inevitably our thinking is going to be affected by how we think today. And that includes our readings of anthropologists and how we view technology. Many of us may be very critical of some technology may be incredible, especially when you think of medicine and, you know, surgery. Certain technologies are just totally incredible, or the technology that allows us to understand black holes that are, you know, hundreds of millions of miles away or whatever. But at the same time, we may be very critical about a lot of other technology because, as Marx stated, you know, the ruling ideas are the ideas of the ruling class. And so all technology ultimately does reflect that dream of a capitalist who decided to create it somehow with our labor, incidentally. So, you know, so it's important that we maintain that critical stance towards technology while also acknowledging how it may be liberatory or help our lives in other ways. And so, I think those were the main points that I wanted to raise. Thank you, though. Great talk, though. And I enjoyed hearing everybody. And just one last thing. It's really great to I've been turning up at a few of these meetings because, you know, as a socialist living in Chicago, and I've been a socialist my whole life, but I was always part of some community of some kind, whether it was when I was in the UK with the SBGB or the people I was involved with the WSP a long time ago. So it's nice to feel kind of surrounded by comrades to some extent. So thank you for that, for allowing me.
Thanks for your contribution. I'll move to the next speaker because it's very short on time now. But yeah, I enjoyed what you said. So, Comran, can you?
Hi, Darren.
Hi.
I don't think we've met before. I've attended a couple of meetings and I attended the summer school.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I spoke there on the.
I wasn't there for the sundown, unfortunately.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Unfortunately. But yeah, I'm a member of Platypus Affiliated Society.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I've been running a reading group. In fact, there's an old friend of yours that attends our reading group, Tom Edwards. Do you know him?
Is he maybe in his maybe 70s?
No, he's in his 30s.
Tom Edwards, perhaps if you...
Apparently you both used to make techno music or something.
Tom Edwards, okay.
Yeah, he attends that.
Is he from Peterborough?
I don't know, Norwich maybe?
Okay, probably about, yeah, okay, yeah.
That sounds apparently you're an old friend or something.
Okay. Yeah.
I'm not too sure. Anyway, I have a two-part question. What is Woods's account of, or what role do the bourgeois revolutions play for Woods, right? Because I was thinking about what Andy was saying, like,
okay,
the revolt of the Third Estate. I think it's Kautsky or Engels says, you know, socialism emerges out of the revolt of the Third Estate. So what role does Woods have for the bourgeois revolutions?
Okay, so...
And okay, the second question, I'll pack it into the first one as well. Yeah. What's the motivation for doing this? Like Woods, what's the motivation behind this? Like these debates seem to be kind of outdated in a way, right? Like Stalinism doesn't seem to be a factor. And also her own account seems to be an overcorrection almost of like a vulgar determinism. But she's not without her own like deep problems, I think. So those are my two questions.
Okay, so Meeskin's Wood. So this book here was written, this is from 95, so, you know, kind of basically when, you know, in academia, this is the collapse of the, you know, the Soviet Union and, you know, just trying to make sure that people don't abandon kind of Marxist ideas in the academy. And so you said, what was the role of the bourgeois revolution?
Right. Yeah. What account does she have of it?
Okay. So in the Origin of Capitalism book, so bourgeois, I mean, what does that mean? A bourgeois is more like a city person, right? It's like a
urban, right? Yeah.
But what she does is she pinpoints, and Brenner as well, the origin of capitalism, not in the city, but in agrarian relations. Because it's not until you get this, the factor that feudal rents become tied to productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with that you get this kind of mechanism for having to develop the productive forces. Mm-hmm. So, there's a differentiation between capitalists and bourgeois, right? So the first capitalists were actually tenant farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. Does that answer your question? Or
not directly. I mean, I was just thinking about what Andy was saying. There is a kind of the kind of question of consciousness is kind of just happening.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I'm tying that in with, you know, I think it's Kautsky. You know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong. Is it Kautsky or Engels? Right, that socialism itself emerges out of the revolt of the Third Estate, the bourgeois revolution, the 1789 revolution.
Right.
So, I mean, I think that, I don't know, puts a kind of wrinkle on Woods's account.
So socialism comes out. So the Third Estate is like civic society.
Right. You have the first and second, which is like, you know, the aristocrats and the religious orders. And the Third Estate is like the urban class, right?
Right, right.
The bourgeois is both like, I mean, 1848 represents the division within the Third Estate, I guess.
Maybe these are different, you know, she's dealing with an earlier period, like in a different, situation. But she's, you know, the whole Brenner thing is looking at, they have this whole thing about previous explanations of the origin. So the whole Brenner debate book is about, there's one school, there's like, you have the commercialization school, which is of the origin of capitalism, or you have the kind of, the changes in property relations in the countryside school. And the commercialization model, according to Brenner and Woods, but I think they're right, it kind of presumes that capitalism is already in existence to explain it. Because you can't, like people said earlier, you can't, if there's restrictions on how big a workplace can be, if there's restrictions on where people can actually labour, then you can't have a, you can't have a capitalist society until you, you know, you have proletarians that are dependent on the market, and you have a market that isn't restrained by this kind of feudal order. So, yeah, the whole Brenner thing is just a main. Yeah, she's a historian, so she writes all the way. There's a, yeah, I mean, this is her motive. She goes back to sort of.
This is a, you know, this is, I guess, this is the kind of debate people have been having about the market, right? Was there markets in ancient Rome?
Yeah.
I think the kind of tricky thing here is capitalism itself is not reducible to a market.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I think, you know, obviously SPGB has a critique of the Soviet Union, and perhaps it didn't have capitalist markets, but it was still capitalist, right?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
I think this is one of the problems with Woods. There's this overcorrection, and she kind of abandons the contradiction of social relations of labor, right? The contradiction between use and exchange brought about by specifically industrial production. So this kind of, I don't know. That's why I was kind of asking about the bourgeois revolutions. Like what's the kind of timeline here? Is it like the 16th century are we talking about? Or 19th century where Marxism itself emerges? And socialism, right?
Way before this, look, you can't have an industrial revolution until you have like a mass proletariat, basically. Mm-hmm. So it's like she's talking about before. This is like a precondition to this, and this is the whole thing with the. If you took like the technological determinist views, it would be like, you know, factories appear, and then, you know, they can't work because there's no proletarians, and then this causes the change. But that's not all what happens. It's the changes in relations happen, and then this causes people to have to build factories. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this is the kind of thing she's. But yeah, I mean, Meeskins Wood is one of the best Marxist historians out there, I'd say, with Brenner. So I guess Steve, and then.
I think it's you'd really come on, would have to have a read through the Brenner. To get a proper idea, because I mean, it's I'd actually forgotten. I mean, it must be about 2 years ago since we studied this in the reading group, and I'm glad you reminded me about that commercialization thing, because basically what Brenner and what Brandon Meatskins Woods are trying to. But one of the things that they want to overcome is this idea as expressed in the Wealth of Nations and then in this commercialization view that basically capitalism was hanging around waiting to happen. So one of the concerns is to deal with that. To be honest, I've forgotten so much of this argument. But just to back up what you're saying, the thing about the bourgeoisie is, the bourgeois cannot, Brenner and Meatskin's view, be equated with the capitalist class. It was, for example, in France, it would be the lawyers and such like that formed the bourgeoisie, and they were not employers. So just leave it at that. Thank you.
Okay. So, well, I guess we're now on time. 9 o'clock, we're supposed to finish. So, I don't know if Paddy wants to wrap up or what was that?
Thanks, Darren. Yeah, that was interesting.
Sharing, if there was one.
Yeah, thanks, Darren. That was really interesting. The discussion was interesting as well. I've read that book as well, the Meatskins Woods one, so I had thoughts about it as well. But so really good. So thanks, Darren, for doing that. Next week, if you don't already know, the discussion is the interesting question: are we left wing or right wing? This is Kevin Cronin trying to bend our brains a little bit. So it'll be interesting to see what he's got in mind for that. So that's next week. And thanks everyone for coming. And thank you, Darren, very much for that really interesting talk.
Thanks, Darren. Thank you, Darren.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for
Thanks a lot.
Yeah. All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.